Hello, this is John McCauley from the band Deer Tick. You're listening to the Kunstler Cast.
Hi everyone, it's your host Duncan Crary, and as John said at the beginning, you're listening to the Kunstler Cast, a weekly conversation about the tragic comedy of suburban sprawl, featuring James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere, The Long Emergency, and World Made by Hand. Today, the Kunstler Cast turns 1 year old, and as luck would have it, the band Deer Tick was in town giving a concert. So to celebrate, I'm going to play a few more songs from that set and talk to the lead singer at the very end of the show. Today's topic is rebuilding New Orleans. Hello, Jim. Good to see you again.
Hello, Duncan. Pleasure.
So formal today. I got into a conversation with my girlfriend the other day. She's studying to become an urban planner, and we were talking about New Orleans. She doesn't think that New Orleans should be rebuilt. And with Obama's stimulus package on the horizon, there's talk of, you know, spending money in Louisiana. And I want to ask you your thoughts. Do you think that New Orleans should be rebuilt?
Well, it's a good question, and I think that there are probably valid arguments one way or the other. We know that a large part of the city that grew up, you know, after its initial period of success in the, you know, the late 18th and 19th century, going from the point where it was a Spanish-French town and became an American town and then became the great port at the end of the Mississippi River. You know, the neighborhoods that grew up subsequent to that ended up in the less favorable parts of town, the parts that had been swamped before, the parts that were submerged very easily. And, you know, then we went through this heroic period of civil engineering from the late 19th century into the 20th century. And that was the period where we were able to build levees and do this engineering that gave people perhaps a false sense of security about living in these places which were, in a practical sense, unfavorable and improbable to begin with. But it made people feel secure psychologically, so the neighborhoods were built. They did end up being the poorest neighborhood, which told you that, at some level there was a perception that higher ground was better, even if it was a few feet higher.
Yeah.
And that indeed was the case there. You know, the Garden District and the old French Quarter, the original grid of the old French city, is a few feet higher than the districts that were flooded and survived the hurricane. The French Quarter did not get flooded. I believe that most of the Garden District didn't get flooded. It was the other areas that did, and they may never be built back again, although people want them to. There are also, you know, there are such tremendous legal problems there. I was talking to somebody. I know a lot of people who have been down there since 2005. A lot of the new urbanists went and volunteered heroically, gave a lot of their time, actually, you know, camped out there. I know one guy who bought a house in New Orleans in order to work there. And there were legal problems such as the insurance didn't cover a lot of losses because the insurance companies declared them to be the result of flooding rather than wind and storm. And they make a distinction about that legally. If you get flooded, you don't get your money. You know, if your house is blown over, you get paid back, or at least you receive your insurance. So that was a problem. A lot of people who lost houses are still stuck paying mortgages for houses that don't even exist anymore. And they'll never probably be able to, a lot of them are never going to come back and rebuild because they're financially wiped out. There was a problem along the Gulf Coast in Mississippi and going into Alabama, where the government established sets of building codes that were so outlandish that it made it kind of impossible and ridiculous to build a house. In particular, you know, a rule that the house had to be elevated so high above the ground to be out of the range of any possible high water, that just to build such a house would be a practical absurdity. You know, you're trying to build a fairly inexpensive house, but you have to mount it on this giant platform.
Yeah.
So that tended to defeat a lot of efforts to rebuild anything, and especially to rebuild anything along traditional lines where you would have, for example, you know, a neighborhood center or a town center with retail on the ground floor. How can you have retail on the ground floor when the state mandates that you have to elevate a building 12 feet off the ground? Mm-hmm. It becomes just ridiculous. So they were faced with that. They were faced with another problem, which was just simply the cultural mindset of the people who lived in these areas, who were completely habituated to suburban-type building. So when the time came to rebuild, they, you know, a lot of them were completely dismissive of building back in a traditional mode with real neighborhood centers and town centers and real neighborhoods. They wanted to just put strip malls back and subdivisions and stuff like that. And so there were all these fights. Then there in New Orleans proper, there was the further problem of the sheer corruption level in the city and the fact that the government was almost paralyzed with corruption and inefficiency. Nothing could get done. Now, I know that my friend Andres Duany, one of the founders of the New Urbanist Movement, was one of the most aggressive helper outers who went down there. You know, he helped organize a number of charrettes in different towns. And he himself made his headquarters. He marshaled, really, all this new urbanist talent and helped deploy it in all the towns along the Gulf Coast and, you know, Waveland and Biloxi and then going in towards New Orleans. And he himself bought a house just on the edge of the French Quarter. And what he discovered was that he couldn't get anything accomplished through the city government. The only people who were even able to make any decision at all were the military people who, you know, to some degree were in charge of some aspects of things. And you could work with them because they could get stuff done. But the city, forget about it, you know. And plus, not only were they corrupt and foolish and stupid, but they themselves tended to resort to suburban solutions to things, or they got hosed by the academic modernists, who also had their squadron of volunteers who drew up plans for the revival of the city proper, and the modernists, you know, led by people like Reed Krolloff at Tulane University, these guys wanted to put in, you know, 1950s style modernist tower in a park kind of urban renewal type crapola projects, or you know, star architect type narcissist art objects rather than neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so there was so much noise in the process and so much cognitive dissonance that almost nothing got done between the property disputes and the legal disputes about title. In many cases, I left something out. In many cases, a lot of the property in the poorer quarters was stuff that you couldn't even establish the title to. I mean, it was so casually and informally transferred from one person to another. You know, an uncle would give it to his niece. You know, a friend would swap it out for a kilo of marijuana. You know, there were no titles. There were no documentation for who even owned the property. So these massive layers of problems, of corruption, of legal problems, of code problems, of bad habits ingrained in the culture, of just sheer incoherent consensus, has really been a huge problem. So none of that has been overcome, really. None of it. And so the whole question even of ascertaining whether some places should or shouldn't be rebuilt, you know, that ended up being such a caboose on the end of the train of these other things that in effect, nothing happened. Whatever federal aid was funneled down there was squandered or spent on things like FEMA trailers, and, you know, some of it was necessary, some of it was you know, crazy. One of the things that came out of the whole experience was the design of a small cottage that was called the Katrina Cottage. It was done by a New York City architect who was among the volunteers who went down there, named Marianne Casado, I believe is her name. And she designed a modular, one-story, small, modest cottage that was actually a beautiful building that could be built cheaply and replicated cheaply, manufactured cheaply even, and you know, hauled as a whole unit onto site. And most of the places that were offered this as a, let's say, a starter unit for the poorer population that needed to be rehoused, they rejected it or they didn't want to be involved. You know, it was too difficult for them. You know, it was too nice for them. So that whole thing, you know, they actually ended up teaming up with somebody, I think, like Home Depot down there, who got into the business of delivering Katrina cottages as already pre-built units. Sort of like a modular ranch house, only nicer. You know, you would, and probably smaller too, but something that had the capacity for being added onto, you know, that it was designed into the structure that you could add onto it at a later date if you could or wanted to.
Well, Jim, I only spent a week down in New Orleans, so I'm not an expert on the place, but it just struck me as one of the magical places in America that to me it's worth considering saving. But part of what made it magical, I thought, was, yes, the architecture in the French Quarter is charming, and the Garden District, charming. But the cultural stuff, you know, just the people on the street and the music and all that is really what made it a magical place. And I think a lot of the people who made it magical were actually the poor people who lived in the Ninth Ward and those, you know, they're just like vinyl-sided or aluminum-sided, you know, tenement. What do you call it?
Some of them were shotgun shacks, as they were called. You know, that's sort of what the Katrina Cottage was. It was a very modest, one-story kind of vernacular cottage.
And those were the places below the levees that were holding Lake Pontchartrain back, right?
Right. And some of them were just, you know, whacked together houses or in some cases the kind of suburban type houses made out of cinder blocks or just balloon framing that were built like crazy in the 50s and 60s and not built that well.
Yeah. So like symbolically, the architecture that is iconic of New Orleans is still there, but culturally there's something amiss. And I don't know, maybe you can't recreate that, right?
Well, let's put it this way. It may be beyond the competence of even the best planners and architects and designers and urbanists to reprogram a city. I mean, what you're talking about is the programming, not the physical armature of the city. To some extent, they had something to do with each other, but you know, a lot of those people will never come back. And I think that the answer to your question in a sort of oblique way is simply that New Orleans is likely to be a smaller city from here on. But you could say that about the destiny of almost every city in America. It's just that it was the transition for New Orleans was more abrupt and severe and catastrophic. But in general, what I believe you'll see, and I've said this many times, is that our metroplexes, our large urban agglomerations of stuff, are going to contract for a variety of reasons. They're going to get smaller. They have achieved a scale that's too big. And so in New Orleans, you see the whole thing happening very suddenly in a very short period of time. You know, there's another thing that we haven't brought up, which is the possibility, and we don't know for sure, but, you know, one of the possibilities of the climate issue is that if the sea level goes up just 12 inches or 24 inches, which isn't that much, a place like New Orleans simply won't function anymore. It'll be drowned, in short.
Yeah.
We don't know for sure that this is going to happen, but there's a fair percent chance that this will happen. And I think that concerns a lot of people in the sense that, okay, the Ninth Ward I guess the St. Bernard Parish and other places that were underwater, that were damaged, they were in danger when the sea levels were lower than they might be in the future. So, you know, what does that imply?
Well, that was kind of the nature of the debate I was having with my girlfriend over New Orleans. I mean, she was comparing New Orleans to the people who build houses in fire-prone areas of California or on, weak soil cliffs in California. And I was trying to say, there's a difference. Like, New Orleans is this cultural gem of America that gave birth to jazz.
Well, that may be so, but, you know, you could say the same thing about Carthage. You know, you could say the same thing about Troy. They, I'm sure in their own times, they were cultural gems. And guess what?
Yeah.
They're gone.
Yeah.
They're not there anymore. It's tough noogies.
Well, I've started to backtrack just listening to you, because I've thought, like, even in Albany, they tried to create an arts district. And you can't dictate that stuff. It just ended up being nightclubs for douchebags. You know, all the artists found another place to inhabit. So maybe I'm being an idiot here by thinking you could even recreate the cultural gem that was New Orleans.
Well, I would put it this way. You're quite right. New Orleans was a very special place with a very special culture. There's going to be less of it in the future, probably. A lot of what's there, a lot of the physical armature of what's there is still very magical, and it's still there. You know, the Garden District, which, by the way, is partly charming because it's in such rotten condition in some cases. I mean, part of the charm of New Orleans is this general aura of jungle rot that pervades the place and of decadence, of decay, in
like
short.
Anne Rice type stuff.
Well, I'm not even going to go into into that programming. It's not the vampire programming, but it's the physical decay that gives the place a patina of mystery and romance.
Yeah, the canopy of trees over the streets.
Yeah, and the Spanish moss, and I mean, it's the same stuff that's missing from seaside Florida that people complain about. You know, the decay hasn't set in yet, so to some extent, it isn't charming yet.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things in this world that need to go through a stage of decay. You know, you wouldn't eat Roquefort cheese a half an hour after it was put into the mold. You know, you put it in a cellar and let it get rotty and the green veins form. And then it's a wonderful thing, 6 months or a year or whatever the ripening period is.
Yeah.
But New Orleans is going to continue to be a wonderful place, but it'll be a smaller place. And then ultimately, we'll see what its fate is according to the realities of weather and climate. We don't know that yet.
I'm with you, Jim. I think I'm changing my whole opinion on this now after talking with you. I was just kind of pissed off that to hear people say, like, you know, they built New Orleans. It's in an impossible place underwater. And I'm thinking, do you know how much crap we built in America that cost a lot of money that sucks so much worse?
Well, look, there's a lot of stuff in America that is going to dry up and blow away or rot away. You know, it's not just the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. It's also, you know, thousands and thousands of strip malls up and down California and Arizona and Texas. And
I'm looking forward to that.
Everywhere
I just thought maybe New Orleans would be worth spending a little money.
We're going to see a lot of stuff transitioning, and not just that. That just happened to, you know, that one happened to really hit a wall. That one had a very severe and rapid transition, and, you know, it's going to be smaller now.
Yeah.
I haven't been back to it since the hurricane, and I had been there maybe four or five times in the late 90s and early 21st century, and I am well acquainted with it from a tourist point of view.
Yeah,
and I saw it live in the flesh at its, you know, I don't know if it was its grandest, but at its largest. In many ways, you know, it was a tough place. It was certainly very violent. You know, even the good tourist quarters, like, you know, the French Quarter, people were assaulted there regularly. And, you know, you'd check into a hotel in the French Quarter and the hotel staff would tell you to be very careful coming home at night from a restaurant, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a dangerous place.
Well, I spent my buddy was going to law school at Tulane, and I spent a week down there, and I did the French Quarter stuff, but luckily he took me to some of the places off the main trail, and so I got to taste something a little bit more authentic. The one thing that was just so striking to me and so great was, I know it's racist down there, but you'd go to clubs and there'd be white people and black people together dancing and socializing, and you just don't see as much of that up here in the north.
Well, they had a very complex society down there where they had over centuries worked out a very hierarchical kind of racial arrangement.
Yeah.
And, you know, not all of it was all that appetizing for us Northeastern progressive folks who want everybody to be treated the same.
Right.
But, you know, they had worked it out to some degree. And the famous, the city was famous for having worked it out. You know, they had their parallel aristocracies and their parallel poor classes, and a lot of it found ways to mix.
Well, I know we have some listeners down there in New Orleans, so give us a call and let us know what's going on. Thanks a lot for talking with me today, Jim.
It's nice to be here, as always.
You've been listening to the Kunstler Cast featuring James Howard Kunstler. To leave a listener comment, call toll-free at 866-924-9499. Send email to letters@kunstlercast.com. You can listen to all of our past programs, join our mailing list, find out how to book Jim to speak in your area, and talk about the show with other listeners at kunstlercast.com. And please be sure to click the link for theme music to learn more about Diertik, the band who performs our theme song. As I mentioned at the beginning, I caught up with the band Monday night, so here's my conversation with Diertik lead singer John McCulley, mixed in with a few songs from their performance. Thanks for listening.
There's all sorts of inspiration all over the place, and even in those suburban cookie cutter areas of the country, it's interesting just to observe people in their environment. And you know, I could never fit into a lifestyle like that, but I can write about it.
Well, don't you think maybe I can.
How are you guys subsisting out on the road as an American rock band? Are you living off cheese doodles at the gas station, or are you finding some places, you know, that have good food and that are worth caring about?
Lucky for us tonight, we're staying with our buds in Albany, and they cooked a meal for us, which is very nice of them. Every now and then, you know, we fall into the trap of having to get fast food and stuff.
Your band started in Providence, Rhode Island, and you relocated to Brooklyn, New York. Those are two of the great American urban places in the country. How do you feel about living in cities like Providence and Brooklyn as an artist?
I feel like I got a lot more work done in Providence. I think the temptations in Brooklyn can be a bit much at times. You know, that's good for creative fodder, but I don't have time to really be creative there. I'm trying to find a spot where I can be comfortable and write, and I don't think Brooklyn is the place for me. I love New York City dearly, but I don't think Providence is my place anymore, too. But I do think I want to move back to Rhode Island and live out in the woods or something.
Or maybe in a small, little small city?
Possibly. I've always loved Wheeling, West Virginia, and have entertained the idea of moving out there every now and then. But small cities are cool too.
Well, John, thanks a lot for talking to me, and thanks a lot for providing such great music. I've enjoyed it, and so have our listeners.
Well, thank you very much.